thank you for tuning in. This is Keith Coogan, and you are listening to The Call Sheet. We're coming to you live and simultaneously. It could be any other date from now in the future as you're listening to us on iTunes or Stitcher or downloading our shit off of the website at skidrowstudios.com. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. We have a very special guest. I'm going to shout out and see if he's with us tonight. Andras Jones, are you there?
I am here. Keith Coogan.
We have...
Can you hear me?
I can hear you just terrific. You sound great. Are you up in Olympia, Washington? Is that where you are?
Up in Olympia, Washington, right next to the Kabbalistic Tree of Olympia.
Ladies and gentlemen, Andras Jones, for those of you who are familiar with his work or not, this guy, okay, Andras, first of all, I love you, Andras, and I love you like a man who is not threatened by you.
That's great. We share that, we can not be threatened of each other.
You had a stronger, did you have a father relationship? You had a much stronger father relationship? I had none. I had zero contact with my father growing up. Was your mother dominant in your life, or how was that for you, both mom and dad?
Definitely a mother-centered household. And my father died when I was pretty young. So
how old?
Well, he got Alzheimer's. This is a weird way to start the call, but I'm into intimacy and transparency. He got diagnosed with Alzheimer's right around the time that I did Nightmare on Elm Street, right after that. And then there was a 5-year descent, and then he passed away in 95.
Wow. Tough on your mom. Did your mom take on the load of the family afterwards?
No, they had been divorced for a while. So okay. Then I had gone and lived with my mom. So yes.
Yes, well, but, you know, this is the kind of intro that happens, though, when I have Andras on. By the way, Andras Jones is an actor, a writer, an incredible musician, and the creator host of Radio 8 Ball, the Pop Oracle, and also an author of Accidental Initiations. What is the full title of the book? Accidental Initiations, that's it?
I mean, that's the best way to call it. You know, it's Accidental Initiations, in the Kabbalistic Tree of Olympia. The Kabbalistic Tree of Olympia is what is the setting, but a good shorthand for it is Accidental Initiations.
It was not only a good adventure story, but was it autobiographical? I presume. Great honesty
in
there.
Totally true. Everything in it is as true as I can possibly make it.
You have a great way with language and a great intellect, Andras, that was able to communicate and touch on so many different things that are interconnected. And I know people talk about, they could call New Age or spirituality. There's something, I think, deeper at that really can't be, I have trouble labeling it and stuff like that. But your description of what you were going through and how... Because I kind of had, Catholicism and stuff pushed down me, kind of a Christian-based, faith-based pushed down on me. And this seemed more, the fact that it wasn't something that I had been indoctrinated in when I was younger, I just felt more open to being able to take it in. And it was really, really enlightening. I see so many times in our lives where, and I guess as men, we go through certain developmental stages. But I'm 42.
Or in the case of my book, why I call them Accidental Initiations. And it goes to what you sort of brought up to start this, which is that in, whether you have a father around or not, a lot of us don't have really good, strong father figures that initiate us into society and hold certain sort of honorable codes, which is one of the things that those male elders would do in a sort of more balanced society.
I grasped onto directors when I would work. They became the father figure for me for those 3 months.
Yeah, we're all looking for these. And then film itself is a kind of accidental initiation. Whether we're aware of it or not, our psyche, our consciousness that moves our being and on some level has awareness across, you know, time and, you know, consciousness, that will find ways to put your body and your mind and the rest of you in a place where you'll be initiated in certain ways into whatever your life is becoming. And, you know, it could be, you know, some of those initiations can be tough and some of them can be glorious, but that's kind of the idea behind almost everything I do, whether it's film or music or Radio 8 Ball, is creating these moments for potential initiation, not into some kind of cult, but initiating energies that are latent in ourselves. In the case of Radio 8 Ball, the awareness is synchronicity and being able to connect with music. But maybe we should explain what Radio 8 Ball is, and I love to hear other people describe it.
I love that it's public, too. You can see other people's questions and their songs. I didn't know that there was going to be a tarot card in there, too. Thanks. Thanks for that.
Oh, you're talking about, that's the online oracle.
Oh, yes. I love that. And by, it is at radio and then the numeral 8 ball.com. And a fun little game you can play there. Try it out. We're posting live on, we have a Facebook page for Skid Row Studios. It's facebook.com/Skid Row Studios. That's it. We're live on there now. We'll be putting up links and such as well. That's where we should share stuff, Andras. Movies, for me, I've always felt that it does put the audiences into a dream state. It is a dream state. It's a dream. It wraps up in, you know, hour and a half. TV, sitcoms are these even quicker nuggets of half an hour dreams. And they're very they're very powerful. A dark theater and these images coming at you 10 times larger than life and Dolby surround sound. And some people are afraid of being in crowds. Some people are afraid of the dark. They're very vulnerable in this state and they're attacked and assaulted by well-edited, put-together, written. And things change. Things move into more, what did you call it? Shamanic acting?
Well, the shamanic nature of acting, and particularly film acting, where because it freezes a moment, and because people are going to watch it and engage it on a very, like you're talking about, a very intimate and real level. When a consciousness pays attention to a person, looking at it through film, on some level, consciously, that person's going to affect that person's life. And what synchronistic film, which we haven't really gotten into, but it's something that I'm really interested in talking about here in this forum.
How stoked were you that I knew what you were talking about when we talked earlier?
Yeah, that synchronistic film explores the way that that an actor's films align with archetypal energies, again, sort of latent in that person. And the more popular the actor is, you would think, the more that works in terms of, like, if everyone's paying attention to Jim Carrey, then we could be projecting images onto, it's a two-way.
He has a moon sync,
loop,
which is pretty strong. Jim Carrey and the moon sync is pretty awesome.
Yeah, Jim Carrey and the moon and dogs and the fool, and it's just perfect. You know, it syncs up really fantastically. And
as a Capricorn and this very pragmatist kind of a guy, I sometimes think that comes to those guiding forces, those producers, those handlers, those agents, those managers that see you as a brand. They go, okay, I'm gonna submit you and put you for these kinds of things. You're going to work with certain types of filmmakers. I don't know. For me, that's one of the explanations for how some of this comes to be.
Well, that's possible, but that's what's really interesting about the sync film that Will Morgan, who who you may or may not be aware of, but he's one of the writers for the Sync book and part of this whole movement of Sync, really a Sync that comes out of Sync Book Press that involves filmmakers and writers and a lot of bloggers and just sort of people who are, a lot of people who might be conspiracy minded and sort of talking about what you're talking about and then sort of come out the other end and realize that, yeah, there are conspiracies going on, but there's also something really weird about media, about freezing time and the way that creates synchronicities that look like they could be, that look so perfectly aligned that you figure that must have been intentional, when in fact, that's just the nature of consciousness.
Do you know how many times I played Night Trap, by the way?
Night Trap, the interactive video game. So you're referencing all these things that are in this film that Will Morgan has done. He's made a synchronistic film where he's repurposed all of my stuff and explored all of these themes. And he talks about Night Trap. And he talks about Attic Expeditions, the film that we share a really interesting sync around. And the reason that this particular one I think is particularly interesting is because my career as an actor is such shit. I mean, that in the nicest possible way, but like none of the films that I've been in are films that I sought out or I had any creative role in making happen. I was hired as an actor to act in films and I gave them my shamanic all. I totally took it on and embodied it in every possible way that I could. But nobody was crafting my career so that it would line up as amazingly synced as Will Morgan's film has sort of made clear as sort of a third party. I always suspected that was going on, but to have a third party come in and having not read my book and not known me at all to make this film that shows how truly synchy film is, even more so, and I think more so if you're an actor, and you may take some solace from this, if you're an actor who's not Jim Carrey or Drew Barrymore or,
I thought about this earlier, Andras, because there are actors that play Sergeant Number One. There are actors that always play Goofball Number Three or Stoner Number Two or what have you. They're going to find themselves in the same situations with the same props, with many of the same actors too, because of genre, and you're repeating these same things. You start to have relationships with these real people, and then you wind up on a set saying, why are you late all the time? And guess what? This fucker's always really late all the time. There's moments where the truth layers over what's going on. It's very LA. And by the way, I had a moment in the bathroom where I realized Twitter is LA. Everybody can talk to everybody. You see random people just going shooting here. You can always shout at somebody going by. They don't have to talk back to you. But Twitter can be, we're here talking to Andras because of Twitter. I'm here at Skid Row Studios because of Twitter, because of probably a 7-word tweet. Hey, you want to be on the show? And it was funny that the person who suggested it had no idea that not only before Attic Expeditions, we knew each other in 87. Through Anthony Rapp and Andy Dick. That was, and that's when I first met you, I think. How did we first meet? Do you remember that?
It was probably hanging out at the house I lived in with Josh Clayton-Felt and, a bazillion other people, at Person and DeLongpre. Mm-hmm. And, Andy ended up staying there when his wife kicked him out of his place, and it was just like a big party house. And Anthony was in from Chicago, and we would have either met there or at Susan Tyrell's place in Venice.
Did we play poker? Did we play poker at Susan Tyrell's?
It's possible. Although if we played poker, that was really before I knew poker. So we didn't really play poker.
No, I didn't know poker either. But I remember the cat. The cats gave me the first time in my life I got allergies that day and got really sick for like 2 weeks after.
I just remember all of the incredibly phallic artwork with all of these dogs with gigantic penises. like gigantic. Like it was Susan Terrell's art, her thing that she was into at that point.
Yep.
God rest her soul.
So, and we knew because Anthony was staying with Susan while he was kind of, you know, in town after the success of Adventures of Babysitting, and he parlayed that into
Far From Home.
She
was in Far From Home. She played my mother in Far From Home, and we really all got really close there. What's interesting about Far From Home is it was shot where Burning Man now takes place. It was the last summer that Burning Man wasn't there.
So we shot
on the exact same spot.
A rape
outside of
teen rape fantasy film, which I noted you guys had discovered was a lot of young women's go-to masturbation film when they were coming of age. That tripped me out. And by the way, the rape scene, you're amazing. I'm sure you were kind to Drew, and she never, you know, was she cool with all of that and everything, the experience?
That's the thing, is she was cool. It's handlers. That's what you're talking about. Like the reason that I don't think that handlers are putting up their art at like Jim Carrey for films that have moons and dogs in them, is because my experience in general is that most handlers are so stressed out and just sort of managing the moment and reacting and, you know, sort of protecting their artist, protecting, you know, whatever protecting means to them.
Protecting their bottom line. They're protecting their money.
Yeah, I mean, all the ways, like whether it's
go off the rails
totally
or compromise.
And they really are protecting them, or whether it's because they're protecting them from meeting other handlers, whatever. I just think that, although I'm sure there's some level of programming in terms of trying to manipulate the way people think, I think there's definitely that going on. And I think at the same time, with a lot of entertainment stuff,
it's called programming.
It's just too haphazard.
I bring it down to editorial, same thing on the news, how you'll be like, why is this stupid squirrel story on? Or, you know, why are they showing this bear? I'm sure there's more things in the world going on in this 23 minutes that you could be showing us. But it'll be nationwide. It'll be, you know, something that will go across the airwaves. I think it's editorial. Baseball movies, all two come out in a year, or, you know, racing movies, or, you know, pirate movies, whatever it is. We see those kind of hedging their bets and studios going, oh, they're doing this kind of movie, we'll do this movie too to try to make the money. What it looks like to me is, you know how many scripts are submitted? Do you know how many people get scripts made when they had no background whatsoever? Do you know how many people work at it for dozens of years and have tons of stuff and then can't get anything done with their script or their idea, which is solid? It takes 10 years to get made and is independently financed, then makes Oscars. But I think it's editorial. I think they go, we got all these options in front of us. Ooh, this is something that's kind of like about the rape of Europa. Let's do it. I think that they could say, let's focus on 99% movies. You know, 99% versus 1%. Let's focus on class warfare movies. Batman, Dark Knight Rises is a good example.
Well, this is a great conversation to explore the, you know, sink around film, because anyone who does a Google search right now for Dark Knight and synchronicity or sync will find a really huge conversation that's going on. And there's something very strange, and I think a lot of people feel it, about that shooting. Of course it's strange.
In the LA Weekly article with Christian Bale, they interview Christopher Nolan, they also interview Christian Bale. He says that Batman is a monster, both the character and the physical Hollywood machine of press and premieres and promotions. And he says you have to take a step back and not take too close or you're going to get eaten. And I love that analogy. He said it's a monster. And I look at it and he goes, it's three people. It's a schism of three, and there's alters, and we could talk about monarch programming and all that other stuff if you want to, but let's keep it on sinks. The alters, he says there's three. There's Bruce Wayne, the billionaire, that's kind of cocky and an asshole. There's Bruce Wayne that's the child that is afraid and alone. And there's the monster that gets the retribution and the revenge for all of this. And he just plays each one of them separately. And And that's how he kind of compartmentalized it. I love that description of it. And then when I thought about it and I looked at just the Batman scenes alone, Batman is a very, very dark, scary character. And I love that Christopher Nolan has framed it in who's good, who's bad, who's the white knight, who's the dark knight. If we're lying about Harvey Dent, are we lying about Bruce Wayne as well? I love that you brought that up just now, and I hadn't thought about what I had read about Christian Bale saying that about the monster, but it is a beast.
I mean, there are some really other, but at the same time, there are some other very interesting sinks. One, here's the question. I'll give you, if you care to have a choice. Do you want to go down the synchronicity hole, or do you want to go down the sort of film criticism, or sort of not in criticism so much, but a more scholarly route?
Well, for
because our
viewers, there are probably, and I have to think that because it's funny, when I posted about your book, I said now is the time for you to read Accidental Initiations, and for the people that saw that post and liked it, I know they're going to buy that, and I know it's time for them to read it. Let's start with the typical treat, because I had somebody comment on my show from 2 weeks ago, not last week's show, but the week before. And he goes, yeah, I listened to the show. I thought it was going to be more like film analysis. And I thought it was going to be like, an actor and how the town works and how to get jobs and fuck that.
I've been through it and I came out the other fucking end
and I'm alive and I'm grateful to be alive, but it's a bone machine. That's the subtitle of my show, Andras. The call sheet, Tales of the Bone Machine. And it really does take young...
Let me give that guy just a really quick something that he can totally use. And this is something that everyone should notice about the Batman series, which is brilliant, which is that it is entirely, almost entirely, a British thing. This is an empire that has done decline and come out the other side as whatever they are. And you look down, from Christopher Nolan to Christian Bale to Gary Oldman to Anne Hathaway to Michael Caine. It really is like an English lesson to America, and America is Bruce Wayne to the military-industrial complex. He's totally Bruce Wayne is the military-industrial complex, and this is It's really, to me, that's really interesting, because since the British got out of the empire building business, you got the Beatles, you got Monty Python, you got everything that sort of this knowingness of the futility of empire.
Did you notice that in Wayne Enterprises, they call the original Batmobile, he said, was, it's not a troop transport, it's not a tank, it's to jump a chasm and build a bridge. It jumps, right? And it has this launching feature, so it's a non-violent vehicle. It's fucking in camo, though. It's a Humvee on steroids. It's the Batmobile from Frank Miller's Dark Knight. And then we get to the Bat in Dark Knight Rises, and what do they call it? They were like, crowd control device or a? It was something for them. It was another non-confrontational.
Oh, yeah, and he
device.
Uses the internet and people's cell phones to monitor everyone. Right.
Oh, and also the zero-point energy device, which I've seen now in Spider-Man. Doc Ock was trying to build one. I've seen it in so many movies, and it's been done to death, and they did it again here. And it's this power device that can kill us, that can turn into a nuke. What the fuck's that all about?
Well... Because you're drawing.
Oh, and they can't use it.
Energy.
Oh, yeah, there's three facets to it. It can create energy, but there's two facets to that. Do we do it for free, or do we make money off the energy? And then it can be corrupted and it can be turned into a bomb. This is incredibly symbolistic, which is
but
not
then,
a word, but I just created
the,
it.
So then let's skip from that to going to getting weird on it and looking at the weird sink that everybody has to feel around this movie. Okay, so the first one was great. We loved it. And Christopher Nolan, who's the awesome thinking from the beginning, really comes into his own. But then the second film, how can you... it killed Heath Ledger. I mean, so he kills Heath Ledger. Batman kills Heath Ledger. And then Batman unleashes the shooter in Aurora, the third one. And whether or not, like, there are people who are going to make all kinds of conspiracy stuff about that. And as a sink head, I just see a phenomenal, weird sink that the Dark Knight is engaging. You know, it's accidentally initiating America into the post-American empire consciousness. And that is going to be hard, and it's going to feel like death.
I know this is real social. In the second one, in Dark Knight, the citizenry was really, really reliant on government to provide the transportation or to provide. And transportation seemed to be about everything. It was on the ferries where they were going to blow the bombs up. And it was this this water system. It seemed to be about resources and transportation in the city. And they also, in one of the reviews I noticed, they said they're trying to paint that economically or that they're better off in the third movie because of Harvey Dent. But are they? And they said in art direction, it's more of a decaying set than in the second film. And that it actually is fallen further, and that people are pushed underground, kind of a Demolition Man style. We're getting all the way back to like War of the Worlds and Morlocks, which goes back to the class divide. The class divide, those that have and those that have not.
Phenomenon overseas is a 29-
Now, I want you to notice something in terms of the Joker
naturally.
And how the Joker sounds.
22 hours. Mm-hmm. That was a fascinating flight.
Listen closely.
What do you do for 22 hours on a flight? You have ways of entertaining yourself?
Well, they show movies that are not a big success anywhere else.
That's Tom Waits. So the joke, that is not, that's not just, oh my God, it kind of sort of sounds like Heath Ledger was doing Tom Waits.
They put them on the planes.
You want these? This is what you're looking for?
Thank you.
I would do that for you. It's a part of the host that's supposed to light the guest cigarette and stuff. I do that, but you look like a man.
He's smoking on the show. He sounds so much like Heath Ledger in Batman. It's very, very eerie. Yeah, it is. And also, I noticed you guys talked about, you threw up Dr. Parnassus online, as some people are, or I don't know if it was you or
right,
I was reading it.
Because the film is so shot through with archetypal imagery, and that, you know, that Heath Ledger is the hanged man in it, and not only is he the hanged man, but again, it's like you're talking about, that he's the three, because Heath Ledger isn't just Heath Ledger, he's also Johnny Depp, Colin Farrell, and Jude Law. And it's part of, it fits into, we were speaking earlier about RKO, in which RKO, the company that, you know, that gave us Citizen Kane, and
which has been pushed by Vertigo, as the top film. Citizen Kane has lost its spot on the list of the best film ever made to Vertigo by Alfred Hitchcock.
It'll never lose my, that's nonsense. But I mean, in my opinion, but RKO.
Which, by the way, the K stands for Keith, just so that everybody understands that.
For what?
Keith. The K stands for Keith.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh.
I didn't know that. I didn't know what RKO stood for, and I looked it up, and I'm like, oh fuck, it stands for Keith.
Another synchronicity.
Yeah, and I've been fascinated with the old It's called Radio Keith Orpheum, is what RKO stands for. I was fascinated with the old RKO 40 Acres back lot. It's the back lot to MGM. It was separated by a few streets. There's kind of three studios. There's MGM, there's Culver Studios, and then there was this back lot. And you've all seen it. It's in Star Trek and the original Untouchables, the original Superman series. Gone with the Wind was shot there. King Kong was shot there. They actually, in Gone with the Wind, when they're burning Atlanta, that's the old King Kong gates crashing to the ground. If you look really close, you're like, dude, that's totally the King Kong gates. So I'm fascinated with this lot. So many things were done in this lot. The old Tarzan stuff. And Westerns and Andy Griffith Show. The entire Andy Griffith Show was shot there. I think later in the seasons they did move it to Paramount. The thing about it is, it resonated to these things that I had seen. And pretty good shows. I mean, come on, Star Trek and Mission Impossible. And they were They were Desi Lu Productions.
And by the way, even by that polls, whatever poll you're citing, even by that standard, the second greatest film of all time, Citizen Kane. And all of the backstory and machinations and history that give that make that, to me, like the ultimate sync film. I think Citizen Kane is the first truly, it's the first a lot of things, but it's also the first sync film because he's making a movie about a real person who's really, you know, who's existing and has to interact with the film.
Right.
He creates a local non-locality by creating a context for his film that was, you know, heroic and doomed to destroy him, and it did. And this is where I was coming back to, because, like, Terry Gilliam is that guy. Like, everything he does gets fucked.
Did you watch the making of Don Quixote? Yeah, of La Mancha, the Man of La Mancha. Great.
Or what he went through with Brazil.
The battle over Brazil.
You know, and then to having Heath Ledger, having his star die in the middle of his latest masterpiece, and then having Johnny Depp from the failed Man of La Mancha come in and be one of the Heath Ledgers.
Right.
Again, the whole film resonates so hard with the hanged man card, because Terry Gilliam is the hanged man of directors, and Heath Ledger shows up as the hanged man hanging by his feet, right? Or does he hang?
I love, he's hanging by his neck. He's got the pipe in his neck, so it doesn't break his neck. He can still breathe through the whistle. Yeah, through the whistle. Yeah.
Exactly.
Dr. Parnassus is the most imaginative and creative movie I've ever seen. And by the way, Tom Waits plays Satan. And there's the sink back to Batman right there. Wow.
Because he's the devil. And Heath Ledger is Tom Waits.
They were bargaining for his soul through free choice, whether man would choose the easy path and fun, riches, and let's, you know, booze and sex and corruption.
Right.
That looks like a party over there. Or, God, look at that walk up all those stairs to enlightenment. Fuck, that's a really long way. What? Happy hour? Okay, I'm coming right over. And the devil would easily taunt him. It didn't seem like free will because of the triggers, and our consumption culture. And I talk about that all the time here on the call sheet. By the way, you're totally number one on the call sheet tonight, Andras. Then don't you love seeing that when, you work, you get on the set and you're like, where am I? Am I 7? Am I 4? Am I, I'm 15. Great. And the person you're in the scene with is like 16. And it's like only 1, 4 and 15 and 16 are working that day. You're like, yeah, I'm back here at 15 or 16. I always loved the call. That's why I call the show The Call Sheet, by the way.
Cool.
Entertainment related thing. And you are.
That's very, very funny and sinky considering our connection through Attic Expeditions. Because that film, and I'm just going to go rogue and on record here. That film used and abused and like call sheets to really screw over a bunch of actors and the writer. Well, particularly a bunch of actors. As great as that film is, it's just like when there's no integrity of the call sheet. And that's why it's so funny. Like, this is one of the things that I try and do in my book. It's getting me in a lot of trouble. And it's just like what sinks do is that they unearth our hypocrisies and where things are inconsistent. They become laughably obvious. And it's just funny that your show is called The Call Sheet. And the call sheet was the device of my and many other actors. It was the gun. It was the gun that, you know, they say some people kill with a gun and some with a fountain pen. Woody Guthrie said, you know, it's like that.
Well, I've been on movie sets where we just call it the daily fiction. We're like, oh, have they written the daily fiction yet? We got it. Yeah, we're not doing that tomorrow. There's no way. And my start was in, like 70s television and Aaron Spelling shows and stuff that had been on for a while. They'd all been, it's like third generation grips that were just like, you know, moving fast as a flat rate. Well, there's no, as a matter of fact, that's why Peter Jackson said he continues to shoot in New Zealand. He's like, I'm not going to shoot in LA where there's these third generation filmmakers sitting around and they're just so bored to death and they're just old running around. And they're there, they're union people and they're great and they're, you know, but there is a spirit to digital and youth and not sleeping.
I think you're a little jaded. I think you're a little jaded, Keith, because I didn't grow up in Hollywood or in Malibu. I grew up in Olympia, Washington, a little bit in Boston, and I moved out there.
No, I'm not.
And I got to tell you, when I was working, I give deference. I haven't worked as much or as consistently as you, but the time when I was really working, those old timers, holy shit. The stories they had as a fan of film, some of these people work with Bogart. Some of these people were on the set when Frank Sinatra insisted on just doing one take. You know, and to them it's just like you and me talking about the stuff that we've done, and like that it doesn't impress us that much. But to some people, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street or Adventures in Babysitting or Attic Expeditions or whatever, or this show or Radio 8 Ball, that has a real power to people like, well, for me, like Bogart or the Marx Brothers, you know, or Woody Allen have. You know, and if you've worked with them, and if you meet someone who's been a grip on one of those things, they're like, oh, yeah, that show was shit. You know, you know, blah, blah. You know, and they have some story to just, like, take your head off. I love those guys. You know, I understand that maybe they'd be annoying to work with if you're a director because they're busy telling their war stories to guys like me. But, fuck. Oh, as a writer, those are the cats. Yeah. Sorry.
I'm terrible at it's tough. You can't repeat people's stories. It's their stories. But I have heard those stories. I've worked with like stuntmen that will tell me stuff about John Wayne and shit. And I'm like, really? Really? And then, back to the weird, another weird thing with Drew. I just wanted to mention because Drew Barrymore, her father and her grandfather had worked with my grandfather. And we never worked together. So Drew Barrymore's father worked with my grandfather often too. They were part of
You're Keith Coogan of the Jackie Coogan line?
Yeah.
See, I did not know this about you. And
I thought
cow. That's
how I get to make all of my friends. I thought, dude, they're going to love me because, you know, the Addams family.
No. All the years we've known each other, right now, this is the first time I'm hearing this. So if you ever thought I was being nice to you because of that.
No, I'm kidding, of course.
That's only going forward. And you've just like, Jackie, fucking A, man. That's Hollywood history. Well, whatever. I'm sure it's no big deal to you because that's what you're like.
We should do a sync on his.
That's what I'm talking about. It's all context.
I want to do a sync on his stuff, too, because as a kid, he often did some pretty sinky stuff, too.
He represents in a lot of ways the inner child. I mean, he's Charlie. He's the kid. The kid. I'm telling you this, but...
Next year is the 25th anniversary of Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master, directed by Rennie Harlan, brought to you by New Line Cinema and our friend Bob Shea. How much do you love Bob Shea?
It's reciprocal. I love him as much as he loves me.
There you go. I think that would be exactly the way it is, with me and Bob too, but I love him, and I got to work on the first thing
really
he directed,
love?
So I was lucky.
I love Lynn Shea, unreservedly.
You know what? I just got
even
a chance to do
here. Love me.
Okay, we're sinking
I think
back.
She's great.
We're sinking back because there's a weird sync with Chris Young and Matt Frewer, by the way, that goes back to you.
Matt Frewer again. Yeah. Another guy who shows up in Will Morgan's film. We're sinking like crazy.
Back to Far From Home. So I even forgot. I've gone down the rabbit hole too far, and I peeled off of my sink. There's in LA is like that though, and pits of New York too. I think the proximity of just so many people, and so many narcissists too, and so many narcissists looking out to see how many other narcissists are there and recognizing them. I'm a fucking head snapper. Yeah. I go to a premiere and I'm like, oh my god, there's that person. I'm such a fucking drooling fanboy, but then also in the industry, it's really a weird, weird place to be sandwiched between. And then you find yourself working with someone.
You know, LA is a hard place to be if you're like it's weird because it's a great, it's the place you need to be as an actor where all the power and the energy is. But it's very hard if you are truly taking on the shamanic aspects of acting because of exactly what you're talking about. Because of the combination of insecurity and narcissism is just, it's not the ideal environment for creating good art, which I can see why. That's what I think. That's what Peter Jackson's avoiding. And when he
probably. By the way, I remember the sink though. I remember the sink. It goes back to Chris Young. And then it goes back to Bob Shea, who directed Book of Love, which was a Chris Young vehicle, and I was his best friend in that. It was like me and him for the movie. And Book of Love. It was Bob's directorial debut, and he put his heart into it. And Rachel Talalay, who directed Nightmare on Elm Street 5, Freddy's Dead, was our producer on Book of Love. So it all syncs back to Bob Shea and Chris Young and some other friends, and Drew. And Drew was often over at Chris's house, and we'd all be hanging out. And I was the one that stepped up to Drew after Saturday Night Live. There was a Saturday Night Live where they spoofed her, and I think it was Jan Hooks, I can't remember, was pretending to be her, and it was this like seedy basement where all of the fallen Hollywood stars were like hooking up. And there's the cast of Different Strokes, and there's, you know, let's go sync back to Dana Plato, and then there's Drew Barrymore. And it was horrible. And so the next day, it's Sunday, and I'm over at Chris's house, and we're all hanging out, and it's everybody's like Jeremy London, and Drew and Roxanne Azal and Meredith Salinger and just a bunch of us all hanging out. I remember more of the girls than I do the guys. And I go, can you believe it's Saturday Night Live last night? And they go, don't tell her. She didn't see it. And what do you mean she didn't see it? It was some fucking Saturday Night Live. They were spoofing her. It was pretty awful. I mean, I wouldn't want that, you know, going on. And they go, no, don't tell her. No, he's telling her. I walk right the fuck over to her. She was in another room. And I was like, Drew, I sat down. I was like, dude, what the fuck? Saturday Night Live and this spoof, gotta get it together. And then she wrote the book and cleaned up. And I'm so fucking proud of her for hearing that. Not me, but for hearing it from Saturday Night Live and from society itself feeding back. And too many actors, and because now it's all about the reality shows.
Wait,
they live for that shit.
Wait, back up, Keith. You're saying that this is something you said to her before she did Far From Home, back right when she was about to write the book, when she was. So we're talking about the same time period. This was all like 1988.
Yep, exactly.
That's pretty.
Oh, and I was on the set.
Mind-tinglingly sinky.
I was also had done a series with Sarah Gilbert, or Sarah Abeles, as she was when she was younger. And I grew up in Malibu with Melissa, and you know, it's so bizarre. Anyway. Was on the set of, they were shooting on Melrose, of Poison Ivy, when they were doing it. And, that's kind of how I had first met Drew through Sarah. Anyway.
And Drew and I have a sync in my, in my book where I do drop her name. I don't do a lot of name dropping in my book, but I did in the little bit that I give to Hollywood, I drop her name because I do feel a particular sync with her. But I mentioned that I took her to, I grabbed her and dragged her into a Buddhist meeting, a Namgyal Rinpoche Care Buddhist meeting.
Yeah, I read the book.
And that was on Melrose. So again.
Oh, no way.
Super sinky. Yeah.
No way.
Yeah, it was right off, Melrose and Martel, baby. It was and I met her, I was right on Melrose. I was oh, so great to see you. And I was so in the fervent cult inspired passion of the Namgyal Rinpoche Care, which, by the way, I still chant, and it's just a part of my balanced diet of cults. Another quote from my book. But I dragged her into this meeting, and since then, whenever I've seen her, that's what we've referenced. But there's very interesting.
LA is very sinky, I think. Street Maps too. Your book in Accidental Initiations, you talk about the Kabbalic Tree of Life in the park in the area that you had lived
in Olympia, Washington, which is the end of the Oregon Trail.
Well, so also the sink right now is
spot.
It was. I saw that it was the end. This is where it ended, right here. Also, currently, the Olympics are happening, and the timing of me talking to you again, brought by a random Twitter person named Kelly, that is, I had put that all together and I synced it back to Olympia and all the symbology in the park as well. The book is great, and I love all the areas of the park. I love the characters of the park. I also love the thresholds, the time travel that happens. I love the descriptions. Your language is incredibly clear. You're incredibly lucid about living and seeing beyond the veil kind of constantly. I touch on it every once in a while. I'm like, oh, that's funny. I noticed that. Oh, I see that. Then I go on about the rest of my day. You seem to be able to stay underwater with a periscope up there. And I'm glad that you've gone down the rabbit hole and done the research and be able to share such a great resource with everybody. Accidental Initiations and the subsequent blog, Accidental Initiations 2, which is, I think you had said it was your way of communicating the way that Accidental Initiations, the book, affected people, right?
And me. How it affects reality to really acknowledge reality and just say, yes, we are all living shamanic lives, and at a certain point in your life, you recognize if you are, in my case, I think it has to do, part of me that allows me to write the book is the part of me that has lost a lot of people and lost a lot of things and created a lot of space in which to explore consciousness once you've lost everything that's important. And I don't mean to say that in any, fathers, best friends, lovers, possibilities, money, all these things. And at the same time, there's still this core of inspiration that exists in an artist. And weirdest things. And I think I think a lot of actors will appreciate this. And this is, I think, the power of Sync Films, is that the part of us that manifested that magic on screen lives and is something that is vibrating and drawing in energy. But the part of us that's inspired is able to live and draw from that, and not in some parasitic, people are fans of me so they'll come out to my show kind of way, which is nice, but in a way that people are putting energy into this thing that I was, and that affects the thing that I am right now. And in LA, it's very hard to really taste the nuances of that. And living in Olympia and finding my Kabbalistic Tree of Life here and writing about that in a space where there really is nothing but total insecurity and some strange belief in my inspiration.
You also do things physically in terms of a tantric sex, fasting, in terms of the way that you allow your body and stripping yourself. And also I found whether by choice, and then after a while you go, fuck it, I'm going to lie to everybody and say it is my choice. I dematerialized. I material possessions. I do fucking love my computer. The stuff.
Think about that, man.
Stuff isn't, I have the classic simple, t-shirts and fucking jeans for LA. Not really into clothes.
I noticed you looked natty. You were dressed really nice, and whatever the picture you have for the show with that tie, and I was jealous.
What? That bridge out in.
No, you clean up nice, man.
I clean up. It's a character I play.
Full on man respect jealousy. I wish I could put my. I could even fake. Even if you're faking it, I wish I could fake it that good.
You look tremendous. You have a couple of really good shots up right now. I don't know the timing between them or everything, but you have some great shots up right now, and I love the Radio 8 Ball shot as well. I wish you were here, Andra. I really do, and I feel like you are, although we're separated by 1,000 miles or what have you.
This is non-locality. It works. The power of our... We always talk about the negativity of our machines, but the power of our machines. We are... Not only are we connected non-locally, we're connected with whoever else is listening right now. And right now could be, any time after now that we're interacting with.
It's both. It is the Heidinger. Yeah, we are, because simultaneously people are listening live and they could be listening next Christmas. Tell us, we have big fans of just the title, Sorority Babes in the Slime Ball Bowl-O-Rama. Tell us about that film.
Well, it was my first film. It was directed by David Dakota, it was his first film, and it was part of, I think, Beyond Infinity's series of absurdly named films like Assault of the Killer Bimbos.
You know how ahead of your time you guys were? Because you know, doing something like that today would, you pack the houses at midnight. I just love it. I love it. Sorority babes.
Well, that, I mean, honestly, that's what I'm talking about. So going back to the book, so there's this sense, and this is the through line, and it's the thing that Will Morgan's film has really unlocked for me, and I recommend everybody who's ever been an actor who's done at least 3 to 5 films should have a sync film made of them, because it really, it reveals stuff that is, you know, it's funny, and you know you're an actor when you revel in something that a normal person would be appalled by. It's so intimate.
Yeah. Well, as a narcissist, I started thinking about it when we talked just before the show, and I was on my way over to the studio. I went, okay, what kind of, well, there's the babysitting sink. There's, what the fuck is he doing in 2 babysitter movies, first of all? That's absurd.
Yeah.
And then I went, wait a second. The first time I appear in Adventures in Babysitting, the very first time you see me on film, I'm cooking macaroni and cheese. It's never referenced that I cook or tried it. And the whole thing, she tries to clean it up at the end. But my character in Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead notoriously goes from a stoner to a gourmet chef. It was just a weird little sink. And I went, then I thought about all the car scenes I've done. An inordinate amount of Buicks. In a weird connection through William Peterson, too, who was always talking about Buicks. And the Buick features in Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead as well. My first car was an Oldsmobile Cutlass Supreme Brougham diesel with T-tops. It was... fuck, the underdog, man. This was awesome. And I find I've done a lot of stuff with cars. Animals, too. Andras, I've worked with fucking everything. Horses and cheetahs and fucking raccoons and squirrels and dogs and cats. Everything. Parrots and I don't know what it is with the animal sinks. So there's got to be some weird sinks in there, too. And animated stuff. Worked with Diggum and Smacks and Snap, Crackle, Pop. And I was the Fox and the Hound. So there's got to be. And then sinking. I've worked with Corey Feldman. Several times, 3 or 4 times we worked together. So there's weird. Oh, you're holding, Manny's holding a copy of Fox and the Hound as we speak. Is that, am I going to sign that off? Okay. That's very cool. I get very excited about that.
So let me just do, like, just a very brief sync film thing on you.
Okay.
So
we have five and a half minutes left, but sync away.
Okay. So really quick, this is my service. To the Keith Coogan fans out there, not to listen to the show. So Keith Coogan, what he resonates on film, chef, Buick, and animals. Chef, Buick, and animals. Well, the chef is already, like, to me, the chef is the alchemist. The chef is the one who mixes the elements. It's a full-on magical job. You are the creator, the melder, the master of... all of the elements. That's what the alchemist does, and it's sort of like an Obi-Wan Kenobi-ish kind of thing. Now the car is the vehicle, you know, would be the chariot in the tarot, and then I would really like. I'm not going to do it right now. I'm just not that fast.
Okay.
But I'm sure that if we explored Buick and all of the totemic resonance of that word, it would be. Revealing. But then the animals is what I find really interesting.
The alchemist struck with me. I've often played guys that do work with chemicals or control things. I've been like train station control. I've done these little parts too that have often been functionary, and they're usually really subservient guys, but they're in control of these weird, huge systems, but they're these underling guys that have no authority.
Underling, okay, get even underling. It's like an animal. Like that's it. So you're this alchemist who's working with the animal, with the animals, with all these totems.
Well, things are, you know, just my names.
You know, and I would love, this is the sync film that
now,
I
listen,
love to see. And
listen to the names.
You're recording this.
Yeah,
and
totally.
And there's a sync filmmaker who will make this film. I would love to see all the animals that show up around Keith Coogan and get a sense of what the totemic resonance is there, because, you know, I'm envious, because what's around me and my stuff is TV screens and redheads. Redheads are fucking crazy, and TV screens will make you crazy. You know, so you're lucky. I wish I was around good food and animal allies. You're a very lucky guy.
And so we sync back to Chris Young, because
Bob Shea.
Bob Shea and Lynn Shea.
One of the best films of the last decade is The Last Mimsy, and he directed that. So
yep. And The Last Mimsy. And Lynn Shea and Chris Young just directed a 3D short called The Guy Walks In, called Dead of Nowhere 3D, and Lin Shaye's in it, and I'm in it, and Chris Young directed it, and we just released it last year, 2011. Lin is amazing. She is so fucking funny. I love Lin Shaye. I'm just looking at my names of characters, Andras, and you've already blown my mind. Crutch, Waters, Stoner, Buck, Pato, Captain, The Preacher. Very interesting in terms of alchemic and mage, magic kind of stuff. And we do live in Hollywood, or I do, and Hollywood is typically used to craft wands in magic ceremonies.
Hollywood. And Hollywood also references the, you know, the tantric reverence for the male member. The Hollywood.
Uh-huh.
Bam.
Bam. Wow. Wow. Well,
and on a positive note, you know, Honor Among Men is a very important chapter in my book. I really appreciate your singing the praises of Accidental Initiations, and I hope people check that out. And I also hope people check out Will Morgan's new film. It's going to drop on August 12th, my 44th birthday. It's called Psycho Cinematic Analysis, and it is the next evolution of Sync Film. It's sort of like it's the crossing the event horizon of Sync in a way that just hasn't ever happened before. So we'll see what happens.
Were you born in 68?
Yes, I was.
So 8. Okay, there's the 8. And then, so 3 days after that, on August 15th, you have a Radio 8 Ball?
I do. I have a Radio 8 Ball at Kitzel's in Olympia, Washington. Kitzel's Crazy Delicious Deli with Kendall Winter, who's an artist on K Records. And one of our sponsors is Oli Kraut, as well as K Records and Kitzel. So there's a tremendous amount of K energy.
Well,
and
Keith Coogan approves.
We don't land on a 3.
Keith Coogan totally approves.
You're part of the K energy too, man.
That's why I was fascinated with RKO earlier too. That's why I was trying to bring that together. We're going to figure this out. When you come to LA, first of all, we got to walk my tree.
Your because Kabbalistic
we were talking
tree
about, yeah, I walk a Kabbalistic tree daily and run it. And so we'll walk it. I'll show you the path that I walk and you can help open my eyes to some of the symbols. And we got to get you in the studio for another hour with Andras Jones. Thank you for calling in, and thanks for your time. We're up. I can't believe it went too fast. And
super fun, Keith. And you don't just have two K's in your name. Remember, because the Coogan, your C is a hidden K. Mm-hmm. You got a double K going.
Yeah.
So
the C is a move. Awesome. I got a whole thing about the alphabet is all about sexual reproduction, but I'll get to that another episode. Thank you for listening.
And the Sunshine Band.
Thank you for listening. Our special guest tonight was Andras Jones. His book, Accidental Initiations, is available now online. We got a facebook.com/Skid Row Studios for all the information. SkidRowStudios.com is what you're listening to live right now. Or if you're downloading us on iTunes and stuff, go to our website. We've got a pretty interesting mission statement over there, and I think you need to join the revolution. Thank you for listening. Good night, everybody.
Tune in to the Atomo podcast.